Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on August 18, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Sundari Sutta. The Sundari Sutta is another sutta teaching the importance of developing restraint. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So I kind of gave this introduction a bit earlier. I don't think Mary was here. The Sundari Sutta is a sutta about practicing restraint and how the practice of restraint can directly end conflict within our minds and also within our community. The last few classes, I think starting maybe last week, concentration is good, but the memory is not so good anymore, are about restraint. But restraint is an underlying theme of the Buddha's teachings. In fact, it really gets to the heart of the matter. And ultimately, what the Buddha's teaching is to recognize clinging to views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And of course, views arise within our thoughts, ultimately. So the Buddha's Dhamma is about practicing restraint at that level of thinking that takes a little while to develop. It's the outward expression of our thoughts, our actions, our words, that we first come to grips with recognizing wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And this sutta speaks directly to that. And the Buddha taught one path, and only one path, to develop restraint and develop understanding, and that's the Eightfold Path. The reason why I say that is in order to find true usefulness in the Buddha's Dhamma, we must always keep in mind the context in which he taught, that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. And the way we develop the end of ignorance, and the very specific ignorance of Four Noble Truths, is to develop the Eightfold Path, which brings profound insight into Four Noble Truths, and specifically into the impermanence of all things, the misunderstanding of self rooted in wrong views, and the resulting suffering that comes from that misunderstanding. And you can see all that very clearly in the short sutta. This is from a part of the Pali Canon called the Kudaka Nikaya, which is the fifth book of the Pali Canon. And this section in the Kudaka Nikaya is the Udana. This, all of that section of the Pali Canon are very short suttas. And some of them, there's a whole, two whole sections called the Terigatha and the Terigatha, which are the preserved poems of awakened monks and nuns. And I just put up three of those poems on the website, and there's a separate section now, and I'll be teaching more to that. But Wednesday's talk was on one of those. And they're just great, concise teachings where these senior monks and nuns are expressing their enlightenment in verse form. So there'll be more about that, but you can check out those three poems on the website. The Sundari Sutta. The Buddha was staying at Anathapindika's monastery in Jeta's Grove near Savatthi. The Buddha's reputation and those of the monks had grown, and they were much revered. They were recipients of much generosity and were treated with honor and respect by the local community. There were a group of wanderers from another sect that were not revered or honored and did not receive much support from the community. Being unrefined and stuck in self-referential views, they were envious of the Buddha and the Buddha Sangha. One of their group was a young woman, Sundari. This unrefined group went to her and asked if she would do something to benefit their group. Sundari replied, "I would do anything, even give up my life, to benefit all of you." She should have been careful. "Well, Sundari, we would like you to travel often to Jeta's Grove to make it appear to the townsfolk that you are staying with some of the monks." Sundari agreed. Once it became well known that Sundari was apparently visiting the monks of the Buddha Sangha, she was murdered by members of her group and left by the side of the road. Very desperate people. Their group, suffering self-inflicted confusion and delusion, then went to King Pasanadi Kosala and feigning ignorance and concern. They told him, "The female wanderer Sundari has vanished. We cannot find her anywhere. We think she may have gone to Jeter's Grove. Quite an aspect of wrong speech, isn't it? King Pasenadi instructed them to go to Jeter's Grove and look for Sundari. They retrieved Sundari's body and mounted it on a litter to display to the townsfolk. From street to street, they carried the decomposing body, shouting to all that could hear, "Look what the shameless followers of the Sakyan Sun," meaning the Buddha, "have done." Though they claim to follow a true Dhamma, they're continuing these words. Though they claim to follow a true Dhamma, they are evil and murderous liars. When the monks of the Buddha Sangha returned to town on their alms round, they were reviled, insulted, and harassed. Returning to the Buddha, they recounted their experience, and the Buddha reminded them of the Dhamma with this verse. I just want to stop there. And I don't mean to, I'm always cautious about bringing politics into our Sangha and into the Dhamma, but there's sometimes that there's some obvious relevance. And look at what transpired here from an initial lie and the desire to make their point of view known. This group, what's the right word? This group took up murder to continue their point of view and elevate themselves to a different status, and then continued with lies and political rhetoric within the town to continue that. It's kind of similar to what's going on today, isn't it? People are desperate, and they're doing and saying just about anything to maintain their point of view. And again, I'm not taking sides here, but it's certainly what's occurring. The political and social climate during the Buddha's time is very, very similar to what's going on today. And the reason why is that the Four Noble Truths are still the Four Noble Truths. People still engage in self-referential views and thoughts, words, and deeds that promote the ideology arising from those self-referential views. So we do it on an individual level, and then as we entangle other people within our own ideology, we create a force that way, don't we? This is just what occurred here. The Buddha reminded them of the Dhamma with this verse. "One always suffers in ignorance who lie about events, as does the one who claims innocence when guilty. These are acting without skill and suffer in this life and beyond." The Buddha then tells them to remain calm, as this difficulty will not last long. After a week's time, this will pass. When you find yourself treated unfairly, remind those that they suffer greatly who continue ignorance and lies as much as the instigator. Both are the same and will suffer the same fate of long-term confusion and suffering. So in other words, he's not saying go back into town, claim your innocence, proclaim your point of view. He tells them to maintain their calm and peaceful mind and simply state the truth. For the next week, the monks repeated this phrase when confronted by the misinformed townsfolk. Eventually, the reaction and disturbance in the minds of the townsfolk subsided, and they realized that the monks of the Buddha Sangha were innocent of any wrongdoing. The townsfolk understood that they had been taken in by those protecting a false Dhamma. Quickly, the thought came to the townsfolk, those of the Buddha Sangha are innocent. This act was not done by them. They have honored their oath to remain harmless. Now, if they took up a position and started increasing the conflict between them and the other group and within the townsfolk where this was playing out, it never would have ended. We may even be hearing about a war that took place 2,600 years ago that started that way. But the Buddha, with a well-concentrated mind, understanding the Eightfold Path, and remember the monks I think it was early in the Buddha's teaching, so it was probably only monks at that time, had developed the Eightfold Path. They understood the value of practicing restraint. And so they did just that. They didn't continue the conflict. They remained well restrained, and they remained within the refuge of the Eightfold Path. And so rather than raising that conflict up even greater and keeping it going, by stepping out of it and simply speaking the truth, the conflict ended and peace prevailed. After a week, the conflict ended. The monk said to the Buddha, "It is amazing, astounding. Having practiced restraint and speaking only the truth, the conflict is over." The Buddha responds, "Those unrestrained, with no knowledge of the truth, sling arrows at others." Sounds a lot like today, doesn't it? "Like one at war. Those who have developed restraint through the Eightfold Path know to dismiss this foolishness and maintain a calm and peaceful mind." That's the end of the sutta. Dismiss this foolishness and maintain a calm and peaceful mind. Imagine, and I'm not talking about those of us in our Sangha, but imagine if there was enough people that understood that. That the most important thing is to maintain restraint and maintain a calm and peaceful mind. The conflict in the world today, and certainly in our country, would quickly vanish because there'd be no fighting. There would be, the rhetoric might continue from one side, and I'm not claiming which side that would be, but there'd be no fighting back from the other. It would just simply end. It's the nature of conflict, isn't it? Conflict requires two parties to continue conflict. The Eightfold Path, the Buddha characterized the Eightfold Path as a middle way between extreme views. Think about that for a minute. Rather than taking a position, and even in the spiritual / religious community during the Buddha's time, those views were expressed as extreme views. The Buddha realized, that a mind rooted in ignorance, meaning a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, is prone to latching on to extreme views, because it is in the extreme view that we're able to create some type of self-identity, a self-referential view of ourselves. We mentioned this before, we have a word for that today, don't we? Identity politics. I identify with a certain ideology. And if you look closely at what's occurring, it's not really people that are fighting amongst themselves, it's identities and ideological views. That's exactly what the Buddha was addressing 2,600 years ago in this simple sutta. And the solution is to develop the middle way, the Eightfold Path. Because as we develop the Eightfold Path, we first recognize the conflict that we've created in our own minds because of our wrong views, our lack of understanding to the three marks of existence. And as we deepen that understanding of the conflict we've created in our own minds, we then understand the conflict that other people create in their minds. And at that point, we can act with true compassion through understanding. But it's not possible unless we understand the process, is it? Unless we understand the nature of our own conflict, our own suffering, we can't truly understand other people's suffering. And so we take points of view, we attach ourselves to points of view that validate our own suffering, and we are usually compassionate towards that group. And I'm talking in broad generalities here, but lacking compassion to a group that we are in conflict with. Another way of saying that is we cannot be compassionate towards someone we're in conflict with. Conversely, if we have true compassion rooted in understanding, we cannot be in conflict with anyone, no matter what they're doing, because we understand their actions are rooted in ignorance. The middle way is the path between all human conflict. It's the middle way between all conflict within our minds and within our community and with our planet. So that's the end of the speech after the sutta. Thank you. Any questions about this simple sutta before we go around the room? And I hope I didn't get anybody riled up about this. It really is just to make the point.
And just to bring to your practice, the conflict is your wrong view. There's no push it. There's no wrong view. So you can follow the path when you develop that mindfulness So you can extend it up to politics or relationships.
Yeah.
But it's that wrong view that you have to push against, and as you develop the ability to go out off your cushion, that you have that alert, ardent mindfulness.
And that's where the true wisdom lies, isn't it? The Buddha would often say the wise understand the danger and even the slightest transgression because of that. Because we then become justified because I think I'm right. And most of us have a reasonable view of what's occurring. Now, I'll bring it back to modern times. Most of us have a more than reasonable view of what's occurring, except many of us get caught up in our own views and feel justified in using those views that maybe seem well grounded in rationalness. But because now we're engaged in conflict, we're only furthering conflict. Think about there's three people that come to mind when I talk about this. Gandhi, Dr. King, and Nelson Mandela. And Dr. King was involved in some political rhetoric, but if you listen to his words, they were hardly ever would rise to the level of instigation. People took it that way. But they were all examples of, for the most part, just peacefully being rather than fighting something. And when you listen to their words, you know, as I'm saying, well, I don't want to get into that. And none of them were practicing the Eightfold Path as far as I knew, but they were rooted in an understanding of the necessary quality of peace. If you're going to promote peace, if you want peace rather than conflict, and again, the Buddha recognized that. This is why he could teach this sutta. You know, this is something that he taught off the cuff, if you will. It's something that arose. The monks came to him; they were upset, and he told them this. You know, this is what you do. This is how you practice the Dhamma. And when you look at the Eightfold Path and understand the Eightfold Path, it guides us through every type of conflict in our life, whether it's interpersonal, something going on between me and a friend or a family member, or the community or the world at large or the country, or, and as importantly, within myself, because that's where all conflict resides ultimately, is within myself. If I'm fighting with someone else or I'm fighting with the world, it's because there's conflict within me. It's not possible to have a calm, peaceful mind and engage in conflict. Would it? I mean, it doesn't even make sense when you look at it that way. So the Eightfold Path, rooted in right view, understands from a profound level the arising of conflict in others. And since it understands it, it doesn't have to fight it anymore. Any other questions or comments before we go around the room? Start with Anthony. Anthony, good to see you.
Good morning, everyone. It's a very timely sutta to read today.
Yeah, I think so.
Considering the political discourse going on.
It's remarkable in that way, though, too, isn't it?
And it's making me think when I was listening to it that there's a lot of letting go involved in that.
Yeah. And a lot of restraint.
You can't, you have your own opinions, and you have to accept the fact that you can't change someone, and you're just going to amp up the level. You have to practice restraint, and it's not always very easy. I've had the thought that the sutta ended in, that if we just, you know, sit back and practice restraint, that the political tide is going to turn, because it seems to always do that.
Always does.
But it's hard, and I can imagine, like, if I were one of the people being tweeted about and being called nasty things, you want to defend yourself. Yeah. And, you know, it's... And you also think that in that political arena, if you don't, people will think you're guilty of something or you're weak.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can understand why they would attack back. But I don't think it's a good thing, because you can't change minds. And I also was thinking, and Matt would appreciate this, that it's very much an Eastern kind of philosophy, because with Eastern self-defense, if somebody comes at you, you don't stop and punch back. You take their flow and eject it the way it's heading, which is another way of It's a sort of physical restraint.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to it. I appreciate the talk. I think it's really timely.
Yeah, I think so too. Thank you. Think about from the point of view of the Buddha, an awakened human being. You know, he could have very easily taken all this personally and told his monks to go get the biggest sticks you can and beat the hell out of those people because they're hurting us. And he understood the nature of conflict and he knew what to do. Remain calm, remain at peace. And it will change. You know, I've lived long enough in this country to see, you know, different views arising and passing away. I've never seen it like this, though. I've never seen such powerful and hateful rhetoric from both sides, and people just becoming intransigent. I think I mentioned earlier, there used to be an underlying feeling. I mean, you could even see it within the workings of Congress, of working to find a middle way, even though it wasn't always pleasant. But that's not even there anymore. You know, we really. But it'll come back. It always does. You know, this type of conflict. It seems to subside over time. Although I have to admit, I'm a little concerned about how far we're going this time. But, you know.
If the press would just black it out, it would go away.
Well, there's the other thing. I don't want to get into a speech about it, but when I remember you got your news, you got your local news at 5 and your world news at 6. And that was it. And if you didn't get it at 5 and 6 and you got it from Walter Cronkite, you know, he's who we listen to in our family. There was only a few individuals that you got your news from. And most of those individuals had a pretty, they took what they were doing rather seriously. They understood the importance of what they were doing. But now it's, you know, it's 24/7. It's more important for people to, I think if you took someone from the late 60s that watched the 5 o'clock and the 6 o'clock news, and put them in front of a TV today, pick your one, it doesn't matter which one, they'd be shocked because there's not much news reported. It's all opinion.
Yeah.
It's all editorializing. And we become a nation, at least, and I think a world, that are addicted to the opinion and the editorializing rather than trying to find out what's the news, what's really occurring here. And again, it's really crazy. But I think we'll come back to some kind of reality eventually. You know, who knows? But. Lorna, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here. To me, the sutta spoke of how dangerous it is to have your feelings ramped up by your own ego. And to protect that ego or to maintain your ego, you look for ways to be negative to other people to boost your own ego.
Yep.
You know, you down on somebody else to boost your own ego. And that's really what the message I got out of the sutta. And also, I wonder, there's the group mentality, I think, woven into the sutta as well.
Yeah. Great insight there.
That the group, they're not the Buddha group, the other group, the negative group, you might say, whatever.
The bad group.
The what?
The bad group.
The bad group. I didn't want to say it that way.
I'm just kidding.
The goods and the bads, there we go again. But anyway, you know, not the Buddha group, but they would do anything to sort of try to build themselves up.
Yeah.
And even to put other people down. And I think that's the Buddha speaks of gossip in that way, that, you know, that's a lot of what, at the bottom of what gossip is, you try to elevate yourself by saying negative things about somebody else. Is that you're actually trying to boost your own ego by, you know, it's the same thing.
It is.
But I do wonder if the Buddha group was not such a big group as they were, how easy or how difficult it would be for a larger group to be negative to the Buddha group, and how it would be much harder, I think, to stay impassive when there's a bigger group. And there's it's I think the group mentality went both ways, that the Buddha group was a large group, so that they could have the group mentality to lock together and stay impassive and not rebel, etc., etc. I think that was easier because they were a big group. If there weren't a big group, if it was an individual, it would be so much harder. Just to stand up for your own views without being able to express, you know. And I think that situation would have been harder. But anyway, it didn't work out that way. And then just as I was a little surprised that the Buddha referred to this life and the life thereafter. He mentioned the life thereafter. I don't know why that was thrown in there. It's just to throw your mind, and it just throws your mind into another space, whereas, and that space is not where our minds should be. Our mind should be in this space, in this life. And to throw that in, that, you know, I can't remember the whole sentence it was in, but he threw it in that, you know, this life and the next life. And I just don't know why that was in there, apart from just to sort of throw your mind somewhere where it shouldn't be. I didn't quite understand his thoughts about that.
Thank you. The reason, the reference there, is because it was just common conversation to talk about that. You know, there was a strong belief within the so-called spiritual community of this life and the next life. And so there was a concern about what you did would affect that. But what the Buddha was referring to here, again, he brought it all the way back to the immediate conflict. And that was what's most important. And he's shown great insight in another underlying theme of the Buddha's teaching is who and what you associate with is going to determine what, to a great extent, what your life experience is like. And so this was he was speaking to a group, and it seems like it was a relatively small group of Dhamma practitioners, and how to maintain their eightfold path by practicing restraint. And very practical teachings, isn't it? You know, and even the idea of gossip is addressed here, isn't it? Through right speech. You know, it's immediate and direct practical teaching. We don't talk about others. Why? Because it's hurtful. I mean, it's just a practical way to live your life. So, thank you. Matt, glad you're here this morning. By the way, Matt has his Qigong class today after class. It's a great compliment to what we're doing here.
Good to see everybody. Good to be here. I really hear the first three suttas strongly in this sutta. Or I should say the themes of the first three suttas in this. And it's just a recognition of how continuous and integrated the Dhamma is, the teachings are. And that this comes back to, I feel like, the third noble truth, which is cessation of craving and clinging is possible. Where? At contact of the six in space.
Yep.
In my own mind, through my own thoughts, I establish myself. As soon as I establish myself, I take a position. When I take a position, now I have to elevate or place this position. That's what position means. You're taking a place. So what it all comes back to in the third noble truth is the third noble truth speaks to impermanence.
Yep.
These things are impermanent. So they cannot be a self. They cannot be real. They cannot be true. Which goes into the second, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta.
And it takes fabrication to establish and maintain that.
Exactly. So that, again, just the integratedness of the teachings throughout all of these suttas come back to one of the three marks of existence of impermanence, is that this is, and where I'm experiencing impermanence at contact, I have the thought that I'm, or the feeling or the sensation that I'm being attacked, or I'm uncomfortable somehow in relationship. Is this me? Is this mine? Is this myself? Well, is it impermanent? It is. So then it can't be.
Yeah.
So we go past where we skip contact, you know. We instead of, well, this is something that we all have to notice in our own experience of when we go past it, when we go, we identify with the feeling and go, hey, that I've got to defend this position.
Yeah.
And as soon as that happens, now mental fabrications are going. And as soon as mental fabrications are going, my consciousness is rooted in ignorance of the third noble truth, which is cessation of craving and clinging is possible. So just a neat way to see the integrity of these teachings.
Wow, what a great way of explaining it. And when we skip contact, we're ignoring what's occurring. And so that is why we practice restraint at the point of contact. And of course, if it is impermanent, think about the profundity of what the Buddha taught, but the profundity of how Matt put it. If it's impermanent, how can it be you? How could it be me? How could I claim it as myself? And it is at that point of contact when there's any type of disturbance. That doesn't mean just being mad at something or upset, any type of disturbance. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. And immediately, whatever disturbance there is, including conflict, vanishes.
It's abandoned. It has to be abandoned because it requires a mental fabrication to continue it.
Continued energy.
Right.
And it needs something to feed that energy. And what is, you know, that's not something that is amorphous or ethereal. That energy is comes from us.
Yeah.
It takes, and that's, by the way, that's, in a word, that's stress to do that, even when we feel righteous about it or self-righteous.
Hmm.
It takes an amazing amount of energy to continue to live with ignorant views. And it takes no energy, you think about it, when you abandon wrong views, because then ultimately you're simply in your life is occurring, and nothing is personal.
And in that way, the Buddha was able to say to the Sangha, keep calm, maintain a mind of equanimity, and just continue to practice the Dhamma.
Yeah.
And in a week's time, this will all shake out, and what's true will be revealed, and it'll continue to be true.
Yeah, it's a four noble truths.
Right?
Yeah.
It was true all the time.
It was true all the time.
But the continued conflict continues to hide the truth. In that way, conflict is a very useful and powerful strategy to continue to ignore ignorance, which is just what's occurring. Or not just right now, since before the Buddha's time, during the Buddha's time, and the 2600 years intervening. It's taken a concerted effort to ignore ignorance, to continue conflict in the world. And I know that sounds like a great simplification, but that's the essence of the Four Noble Truths, within ourselves and without. And we could, one of the things, I've said this a few times, and I probably wouldn't have seen it, except being fortunate to have this seat, is the powerful and very, very subtle strategies we all employ to continue to ignore our own ignorance. It takes a lot of work. And it usually takes associations with like-minded people to do that. And here, this to me, this is the remarkable thing about the Buddha's teachings and the timelessness of it. This sutta is just as relevant today as it was 2,600 years ago, as is all of the Dhamma. It just works. It's timeless. Thank you. That's what Buddha's words, too, when he awakened and he first started teaching. He says, I discovered a timeless path. It's proven true. David, good to see you.
And I always like to bring it back to our practice. As you sit and meditate, you experience that continually until you start, you know, building that concentration.
Yeah.
That the fabrications arise and they pass away. So that's that conflict.
Yeah.
You're bored, so I'm going to think about something I had to do next Tuesday. How hard is that then? But when you calm yourself and you're at in that present moment, there's an ease. There's no stress. And then when there's something that arises, there's that stress again. And then passes. So it is very, you get these then lessons and instructions about restraint. And that's just kind of fleshing out the truth.
Yeah.
The truth is simply, it's there. And you're asking yourself to show restraint at the sixth sense base. And I read this sutta, the Sava Sutta.
Yes, Sava Sutta.
And it was, and they referred to it as the all. And that's what you're guarding against. I always like the imagery of all the mindfulness, like the gates, you know,
yeah,
protecting the gates,
yep,
and unwholesome thoughts. And you know, it is very instructional. And I guess that girl should have, you know, instructions of, you know, who you're associated with.
Yeah, it's too bad she didn't.
Yeah.
Thank you, David. And thank you for your description of what occurs during meditation, because it's in between the thoughts that we're able to experience, even if it's just a moment free of conflict within our own minds.
And your instructions is return to the breath, return to the body.
Oh, we come back to the breath. And noticing the arising and passing away of feelings and thoughts is a direct teachings on impermanence and the arising and passing away of all phenomena. And during meditation, we can observe it within ourselves by simply practicing restraint. And at that, where that occurs is not continuing to be caught up in our thoughts. The instructions are, recognize when you're caught up in your thinking again, come back to the sensation of breathing. You're interrupting conditioned thinking. You're interrupting ignorance at that point. And there's peace in that moment. And we build on that peace. The concentration that develops from right meditation, the meditation as the Buddha taught it, is a mind resting in that peace, isn't it? And it's able to stay in that concentrated space and hold the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path no matter what's occurring. And it's just a simple and practical teaching. Thank you, David. Andrew, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good morning. Well, thanks.
Good.
After hearing this sutta the first time some time ago, it made such an impression that I found myself making use of it. And without control, my anger tended to rise at certain points, and then I would remember the sutta. So I call it the wisdom of restraint, and then I would begin to breathe, and I'd see the effect of it, and I've used it consistently. So it's been a great benefit to my life, and it's very good to hear it again. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. This is everything the Buddha taught is to be practically applied in our lives. There's nothing magical or mystical. There's nothing about we'll gain benefit in some other life. It's right here, right now, that it works. And it does work. It was just about a year ago that I gave this talk the last time, I think. So it's great you've been using it all that time. Mary, good to see you.
Good to be here. Good to see everyone. Good to see you guys back again. We just came back from a family road trip of 4 days, so restraint was used sometimes. Sometimes I was way past it. By the time I turned around and said, wait, what just happened? So it is very practical. It is very useful. And at one point, after an argument about directions and who was navigating and how well or not I was navigating, my oldest daughter says to me, Mom, it wasn't personal, it wasn't about you. And I was like, ugh. And I did. I said to her, I said, well, that's very mature. You're right. I'm done. I'm gonna, good night. She absolutely was right.
Everyone go to their own rooms.
Yeah, it's all separate. And nothing had happened, right? We were just in a city, we didn't know how to navigate around, and it just felt like everybody ganged up on me, but it wasn't. Those were my sense gates, you know? But it is very practical to use every day. It helps with the recovery from those situations, because if you are on a family event and you're all in a different city or place that no one person really, you know, has the bearings, if you will, and then, you know, it's easy to sort of lose your way or become reactionary or whatever. So the ability to recover and, you know, have a nice day the next day and for everybody to return to be, you know, peaceful, that happens because of the practice, where I know earlier times in my life that could have dragged, something like that could have dragged out for a few days. I hate to say that, but boy, we're not a waste of time. So it is very practical, and I think, you know, as with every sutta, it's always wise to bring it all back to the basics of the Four Noble Truths. You can always find the three marks, and it's only the eighth that leads you out of the confusion, the delusion, the reactionary behavior, the behavior that justifies protecting yourself, whatever it is, whatever sense gate it came through, whatever the thing is that's coming into your life. I think the whole concentration just brings you back each time to, can I acknowledge or become aware of the arising as it's arising, versus the example I use. I was 9, you know, miles down the road before I went, where is anybody? I'm here alone in my reaction to, you know, being attacked or something. But the sooner you can learn, experience that, the First Noble Truth, this, if you could experience the Four Noble Truths in the rapid fire, that you experience something coming through the sense gates and then your reaction to it. Like, I think that's the trick, to flip the whole model so that you're like, oh, gee, there's the suffering. Pause.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, there it's arising. Pause. Oh, this can go away right now by changing my view. Pause. Peace and equanimity. And then nothing would have happened in that car, except we would have gotten the 5 miles from where we were today. So really, I laugh about it because it does underscore the silliness of what we create in conflict.
Yeah.
And the strategies, the well-worn strategies that we use to protect ourselves or justify or, you know, whatever it is. In the moment. I mean, I use that as just a recent example, but what I just described could apply to any kind of conflict or delusion or whatever that we're experiencing in our life, and not realizing, like, A, recognize the delusion or the strategies you're using, but very quickly, it's like the concentration allows us to bring it back to, well, where did it come from? Not in an overly analytical way, but what sense gate did that come through? And I didn't see it. Anyway, so a work in progress. I appreciate being here.
Thank you. Again, Mary shows such great insight. I was just, I had a conversation with a student on the West Coast, and we were just laughing about the absurdity of ongoing eye making, you know, because it really is when you can look at it that way. It's just absurd, it's silly. So excuse me for being a little personal about you and David, but in a very direct way, the practical benefits of your Dharma practice has diminished conflict, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. I would have blown up that weekend.
And isn't that and again that would be a, you know, normal. Families get together and go on a 4-day road trip. They tend to fight a lot. They just do, and yet, because you have developed well concentrated minds and the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, it was greatly diminished. It's amazing. I interrupt you. I'm sorry, Dave.
It's just the skills. Byproduct skills of it. I would have blown up that weekend, and it would have been a long 5-hour ride home, and it would have been into today and a week, and our kids would have gone home, and all that time we miss.
Yeah,
right. And that's a really
and that's just byproduct, because that's not even, that's almost like, to me, that's the equivalent of I find relaxation and meditation. But the real benefit all of this is that you start seeing the truth.
Yeah.
And you spend less time reacting and just living.
Yeah.
Within that framework. And it becomes easier. And I've only done this in a year or two, but it's just good life skills.
Simple practical benefits, but the most important practical benefits. Worth the price of admission, wouldn't you say?
Right.
I don't mean just $15 to come here. I mean the price of admission of actually developing the Dhamma,
right.
Of engaging in it. Yes, and it has. You're not conceptualized. You're not hearing. Well, if I'm a Buddhist, I really should be compassionate. You're taught how to be compassionate through the Eightfold Path. It's not conceptual at all the way the Buddha teaches in Buddhism, and it works. And so you're a perfect example. Like the reason why I kind of picked you out is you're a perfect example of the Sundari Sutta. You've developed the Dhamma to the point where it's diminished conflict in your mind and in your life and in your family. That's how it works.
When you do really start thinking about, before you say or do anything, what is your intention?
Yeah.
And if you don't have that practice, developing practice, you don't ask that question. Even if
you
it's
don't.
Like a nanosecond, now there's what's your intention to bust in her chops about not giving me the directions fast enough? What's my intention?
In a city, I don't know how to drive. Right.
You know, and I got support from the two girls in the back, hammering on her. The conflict was at least diminished. So
we rebounded quickly.
Yeah. And again, it's just a practical application of what you've developed
right.
through the Buddha's Dhamma.
Right.
That's why he taught it.
And just like in our situation, we have a 19 and 21-year-old who still want to come on vacation with us. Right?
Yeah.
So if we had gotten too far off track, we would have gone on to continue to miss the opportunity to be with them, and what horrible examples we would be as people, as people they might want to become. I don't know. You know. So.
Well, and what a practical example of how it allowed you all to continue to be present for what was occurring, rather than losing the whole trip to being stuck into the past. Of why did they do that? Why did she do? Why was mom this way? Why was she this way? And the future about, I can't wait till I get home to get out of this. You had a pleasant experience. That, I mean, again, it's just, that's what it's like. That's how it works. We're able to stay present with our life because there's no more conflict in my mind. I don't need anything to be different than what is occurring.
Well,
isn't that marvelous?
I think you kind of said it too, that there isn't an expectation that we're going to somehow become practicing, like to be enlightened is to be practicing this you know, in every moment to have that heightened awareness, right? So on the path to getting there, you're not always going to be there. And I think there has to be some understanding. Someone once said, making a reference to somebody with a Buddhist practice, that somehow they don't always see it in that person who's trying to have a practice, right? And the reality is, you're not going to always see it. You know, we're on a path, we're learning, we're living in the phenomenal world, and until we're enlightened, we're not.
Yes, and there's the middle way again. The Dhamma itself is very specific. It doesn't give itself well to adaptations, accommodations, or embellishments. It either is or it is, isn't. But within the Dhamma, there's nothing absolute. It's simply, as David described and you're describing, it's simply a process of awakening. And so there can't be anything absolute within the framework of the Eightfold Path. But it gets us to that point where we're awakened. And you also describe the First Noble Truth without it getting out of hand. Dukkha occurred on the trip. It just did. It didn't have to be any different than it was. And you continued to maintain a calm and peaceful mind. Thank you both. Sorry for picking on you. Poppy, good to see you this morning. I'm glad you came.
The whole time you're talking about the teaching, just, again, the practical use.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I have a challenging work environment that's filled with conflict. And just how this teaching applies to the situation I'm in. There's a lot of conflict between management and staff. I'll call it. Each side feels like they're correct.
Yeah.
Attacks each other. It's a very negative environment, difficult environment. So, you know, again, I'm on that path of awakening, learning, how to handle that difficult situation. You know, I call it every day. I try to go into the office and stay in my bubble. But that bubble is, you know, that calm, peaceful mind, and not to get sucked into the venting, the gossip, the negativity there, because I've been struggling with it because it's draining to go into that environment. Absolutely draining. You know, so I'm working on, you know, staying in my bubble, I'll call it, having that calm and peace and not getting sucked into that environment.
That's great. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, Poppy. As you continue to develop the Dhamma, you'll be able to more and more stay in that bubble. You know, another word that we use would be the Dhamma is a refuge. Your meditation practice is a refuge. And you can take that with you and maintain a calm and peaceful mind in an environment that's less than peaceful. And isn't that wonderful? Isn't that the point, too? You know, so I'm glad you're here. And I think
it's also having, you know, for me, it's having that self-compassion when I do step out of that bubble, call it, you know, not feeling like I failed, but trying to, you know, bring myself back there a little sooner. So I think having that self-compassion that I'm not always gonna, you know, have that calm, peaceful mind in that environment, and it is a difficult, you know, difficult situation. So for me, it's having that self-compassion that, you know, I'm learning how to do it. I'm still learning.
Yeah, and there's a little more to learn, but again, as you continue to develop it, you'll find that calm and peaceful mind is there. And some of that, the maintenance of a calm and peaceful mind comes from understanding the nature of conflict around you and where it's coming from. You understand why people are becoming, we just talked about it, and it was the whole class today was about the nature of conflict arising in the world. You'll hear me say often that we also gain the ability to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states of our own, because we understand the impermanent nature of it. So even when I find that my mind is agitated in this moment, I don't have to react further or justify it or blame others. I simply understand that it's an impermanent mind state. Take a breath or two or three, and then give better directions and go.
I'll try better next time.
I'm sorry, Mary. Thank you, Poppy. As far as your Dhamma practice, I think I've told you both, there's guided meditations on the website that you can download and listen to, and all, the whole I mean, there's, I think there's now over 350 videos and 450 talks and 180 articles. So you have a weekend at least that you can go through. Good. Make use of it. There's a lot of good information there. So glad you're here. Mary, so good to see you this morning. How are you? Right.
You know, and if when I get into an agitated mind state, an anxious mind state, I find that I am more quickly coming back to the Dhamma and coming back to, you know, this is what's occurring right now in your mind or in your life or whatever, and just, you know, go garden, this too shall pass. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it's helping me a lot to be able to more quickly settle myself. This sutta is just so timely and just, I mean, it's timeless. It would be relevant to anyone, anywhere. We could just tune in well.
Thank you. Again, isn't it wonderful to just have this practice and be able to practically apply it in those stressful situations? And that it works, you know, it's not just a little trick that we're playing with ourselves, you know. We're not reaching for a drink or a drug or something else. Take a breath, and we come back to an understanding of what's occurring in the nature of our own agitated mind states. Thank you, Mary. Glad you're here this morning. Matt, good to see you.
See you. I think what struck me in the talk was more about how you go back 2,600 years. Everyone, I think, this day, everything is so in the present and in the now. We don't ever look beyond 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. To look at history, to realize that some of the issues that are happening today are happened 2,600 years or even longer. You know, is it a part of mankind? Is it part of who we are? But we always think, oh, well, this is new. But you know, there's been polarizing figures in the world for, you know, hundreds, thousands of years.
Yep.
We've always gotten past it. It's a pattern. And, you know, and everyone thinks the world's going to end because of this or that, but we always seem to, maybe it's cooler heads prevail, or things tend to come back to an equilibrium, and I think that's just part of nature, that it always finds a sense of balance when you're up or you're down, and I guess it's just a matter of waiting for that sense of balance to come back to where everyone's more at peace with who they are and with the world. And but it is, it's eye-opening to see that things happened so long ago where that can relate to things that happened today, and how the same message that was given 2,600 years ago is still pliable today in practicality. It's really that's powerful.
Thank you, Matt. Yeah, it's just remarkable to me that, you know, this. If the Buddha was alive today, he'd probably give the same sutta, you know? He might be on CNN or something when he gives it. conflict is conflict. You know, another word for conflict would be dukkha. Dukkha arises out of ignorance. And so the underlying theme for conflict to arise is ignorance. And so the antidote, the solution, is wisdom. And it's again, it's not some magical, mystical wisdom. It's not the wisdom of Gandalf. It's the wisdom of what is human life really about? What am I really about? What am I? You know, to go from a misunderstanding and misapplication of views rooted in ignorance to a simple understanding of self is the essence of the Buddhist teaching. And again, that kind of flies in the face of those that would say there's no such thing as a self. Certainly there is. And there's a loving and compassionate self that arises from an understanding of the true nature of human life. That's what the Buddha taught us, how to be fully mature human beings. That's what his Dhamma is about. And a fully mature human being doesn't take things personal, does it? Children take things personal. You know, we see that all the time. Even some, well, I don't want to go there. Almost made an extreme political statement, and I won't. I just practiced restraint, by the way. Did you notice? Did you see it?
I did.
I'm learning. A few, what a great class. A few announcements that I had online. We're collecting money. A present Donna project is we're collecting money so that the Raritan Learning Cooperative, a great alternative school, if I call it that, and it really, that doesn't even do it justice, but that one of our Simon members, Mary Beth, is a part of in Flemington, they need a road sign to help promote their business. And so there's a basket out there that we're taking money for the next couple weeks. And whatever's in there will contribute to the Raritan Learning Cooperative, so they can put a nice sign up. Our retreat starts in a little over 4 weeks. There's still plenty of room, so if anybody decides they want to go that's not already signed up, please join us. It's just a wonderful 3.5 days to be immersed in the Dhamma and get a really strong understanding. There's no other way, and I don't want to sound like I'm selling it, except as your teacher, I'll tell you, that there's really no other way to integrate the Dhamma in that way of just being immersed in, you know, there's quite a few talks, but there's also plenty of time for rest and contemplation. Matt will be there leading Qigong, which is just a great complement to our retreat. There was something else. There's two more categories that I put up on the drop-down menu on the website. One is the Wisdom of Restraint that categorizes five other suttas on restraint. I thought it's about time to put them that way because it's such an important thing. And the other category that I'll be adding to is on the Theragatha and the Theragatha, about those poems of the elder monks and nuns that I mentioned earlier. There's three suttas on there, and they're not really suttas, there's three poems on there now, and I'll be adding more, and I'll probably give some talks on those too, because they're just great teachings. So I think that's it. The other one is our Dana Dinner is on again. We didn't have our spring one like we usually do, but we're going to have one Tuesday of Thanksgiving week at Love and Oven again. So thank you for all that. We'll finish as we always do, and please don't forget Matt's classes right after ours. We'll finish with metta, so find your relaxed meditation posture. And again, gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And let me just call it up. And again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.